Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Focus on Albany. I'm Cynthia Cooler, and my guest today is Angela Clark. And Angela is an organizer for the Cabot area. Help me out, please. I'm sorry.
Angelica, Capital Area Against Mass Incarceration.
And Angelica is going to kind of talk today about the Donald Ivey case. So, you know, there was talk about, you know, tasering, and that could be, you know, considered police brutality. Kind of give our audience an overview of your understanding of the case.
Sure. Okay. So on, you know, the sort of morning of April 2nd, Donald Ivey was walking down the street, heading back to his home from the corner store that he went to every night. And he was stopped by three men he didn't know who happened to be officers. And they proceeded to have an interaction that led to Dante being tased three times and ultimately dying as a result of being tased. And recently, his death has been ruled a homicide by the coroner's office for Albany. And the grand jury investigation into his case has been open for many months and has recently sort of hit a roadblock because the district attorney, David Soares, has made it contentious as to whether or not it's actually his obligation to investigate it, because there was recently, in the past couple months, there was an executive order from the governor's office around the deaths of unarmed folks at the hands of police, and essentially a shift that those cases would have to be investigated by the attorney general's office in conjunction with a local district attorney's office. However, Dante was killed before that time, technically, under the order, the District Attorney David Soares is still obligated to investigate and pursue that case to the fullest extent of his ability, as he would for any other criminal case that comes before the District Attorney's office.
So, why was he stopped and why was he tased?
I mean, we haven't really gotten all the details on why, but what we have been told is that he was stopped because it was a very cold night. Folks probably remember April, still very wintry weather, still some snow on the ground, and he had his hands pulled over, or his shirt sleeves pulled over his hands, and the officers thought that was suspicious. So they proceeded to interact with him on that basis of just his hands being covered on a cold night because he didn't have a coat on. So that was sort of the reason for their stop. Although, according to all the folks in his neighborhood who have been talked to since then and his relatives, he made, unfortunately, that same path every night. So that was not like he sort of lived on a schedule. And he went to that store at that time because he didn't like to be in big crowds of people. So that was something that was a routine for him, that if those officers had been policing in a way that they knew the regular behavior of the folks walking down the street, they would have known that that was his regular nightly schedule and wouldn't have stopped him, and wouldn't have stopped him in such a way that didn't take into account anything about his mental state or his mental health status, which was also an issue that came up with that particular interaction, was that they didn't account for the possibility of him having mental health issues, despite sort of having a unit of their police force devoted to that. That didn't come up, and they didn't attempt to address that night. And it was later revealed that Mr. Ivey was diagnosed with schizophrenia. So he should have been approached in a different way. And had they been integrated into the community, they would have known that and wouldn't have had that interaction that night.
Now, has there been any dialogue, police department or the mayor's office, about this particular incident, and what is the dialogue?
So initially, there was some dialogue between the New York Civil Liberties Union and the Albany Police Department almost immediately after it happened, because they have a report that essentially sort of looks at all the hazing incidents that took place in New York State and show New York State to be a particularly egregious place and Albany County to be a particularly egregious place for the excessive use of tasers. So they essentially brought that report in and offered the report, but also sought information, right, and tried to have a conversation and say, hey, we all know that there are issues with the way that you use tasers. And at this point, they've cost the lives of multiple people in this area. And the Albany Police Force at that time offered up a new set of regulations around tasers that they said they had sort of waiting in the pipeline time, but had not implemented yet. But I think it's really important to note that even under those new guidelines, the tasing of Dante Ivey that led to his death would still be lawful, because it maximizes three uses at one time. And that's the number of uses that led to his death. So that initial move that they made to update their regulations is not adequate, because it still would have led to his death and likely will lead to more deaths and more injuries, grievous injuries, at the hands of a police officer wielding a taser.
Now, one issue that's been brought up over and over again, across the country, is police brutality.
Mm-hmm.
From your perspective, how pervasive is police brutality in Albany?
I mean, from my perspective and from the perspective of people who have been working in the community on this issue for many, many decades, it's quite pervasive in Albany City. The amount of incidences are sort of, it's innumerable, because oftentimes people who are the victims of that brutality don't know where to turn to report those kind of incidents. And unfortunately, even officers who have repeated cases of brutality, because there are multiple officers who engage multiple times in brutality in Albany, there's no way to track, at least not for civilians, to track who those officers are and to make demands around changing personnel as a result of that. Like if one particular person or multiple people have a repeated, history of engaging in brutality, there's something going on. Although it is a systemic problem, it also can be specific to individuals. So there needs to be a multifold approach to that. And in order for that to be possible, civilians have to have the information. So unfortunately, there's not like a record that we could go to that would tell us, a public record that would tell us exactly who on the Albany Police Force is engaging in brutality. And there's no way to really know how often, because they don't report those kinds of things. Every incident where force is used does not get reported as a use of force incident, because oftentimes it'll be sort of a happenstance moment, and then that person just has to go home and with the fact that just happened to them, because they aren't arrested and there's nothing written down. So there's a lot of difficulty in tracking the numbers, but just from folks who have been in the community for many decades, and from folks that I've interacted with in the past few years, it seems to be pretty ubiquitous. Like, it's happening on a regular basis, and it doesn't seem to be coming up to the top of the police department in terms of like them being aware that this is happening on a daily basis to people in the Albany community at the hands of their staff.
Now, police brutality, it's a catch-all phrase right now.
Mm-hmm.
Let's break it down by race.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say over the years it's been white police officers versus black citizens? Would you say that the racial makeup of police brutality is?
I think Well, that's kind of a complicated question, and I think it's complicated for a couple of reasons. One being that depending on where you're physically located, the makeup of your police force is going to be different. For where we are, it's a very uncomplicated question, but in other parts of the country, it's a much more complicated, much more nuanced question about the ways in which systems reinforce racism versus individuals being sort of needing to be racist in order to engage in racist practices. Here, that's not, you know, it's much easier to visualize it or sort of like historically place it because the police departments are overwhelmingly white and the people that they brutalize are overwhelmingly Black. But I think that that's like, it's not as simple as that. I think it's about the history of police departments and why they exist. And that's part of why brutality is such a commonplace thing in police departments, is because the origin of the police departments in this country are slave patrols, fugitive slave patrols. So people whose job it is to go and round up people who run away from plantations and return them to their owners. And then over the course of a couple decades, that transitions into the same people who did that are now the people who enforce the law at a time when it's legal to brutalize Black people. And so that legal brutalization became a part of the policing structure in this country. So even though now we have technical equal rights under the law in some ways, that's not really true because the institutions that operate still think about Black people as bad. And socially, the world thinks that way too, right? That people who commit crimes are bad. Overwhelmingly, the people who commit crimes are Black in people's mind. So that means it's okay to hurt bad people because bad people are not really human. They don't really deserve the same rights and privileges that the rest of us have. And that results in a policing practice that dehumanizes all Black people that they interact with, particularly in poor communities, because they just don't have a context for them being anything but this criminal that they've put in their head, this image that they've had, that they've been ingrained in their head from the academy, from the policing texts that they've read and learned, and just from living in our society, which is unfortunately, you know, a society that is living with the legacy of slavery and also you know, existing under white supremacy, right? So there's a lot going on when it comes to what it looks like to police in communities and why violence happens when people are out policing. And part of it is interpersonal, but a lot of it is systemic. A lot of it is that, unfortunately, as a society, we still accept police beating people up and don't think that there's anything wrong with it because we don't think of people who commit what we call crimes as human beings. So that's one of the root causes of it. And the other sort of root cause would be that we don't see Black people as human beings. So then they're to be sort of damaged in whatever way, you know, is in the mind of police officers interacting with them that day. And there aren't really checks and balances in our society to prevent that stuff from happening.
Now, there's a little bit of friction between the governor and the district attorney. Can you explain what's going on?
Yeah, sure. That's sort of the same. I mean, this is New York, right? We all kind of know that all the politicians in New York seem to have really big egos, and those egos are reflected in the policies and practices that they put out. And unfortunately, you know, people, the regular folks of New York State are the ones who become the casualties of those kind of policies. So they're right now having a disagreement over whether or not the executive order that the governor enacted would apply to the case of Dante Ivey. And D.A. Soares has been out on behalf of the District Attorney's Association opposing that particular executive order, saying that it's not clear and that, you know, it's hard to understand what they actually are expected to do, you know, and unfortunately for us, right, like that sort of gets us mired into this legalistic conversation. But really, that's not the point of what either the executive order or what the duty and responsibility of district attorneys are. So really, that's kind of, we're getting mired up in a conversation between two seemingly large egos that unfortunately in this situation, the casualty of this conversation is Dante Ivey and his family ever receiving justice. Because D.A. Soares has now sort of backstepped away from his investigation into Donald Ivey's death. So now, you know, it's not clear what will happen with that case. And this is all over a disagreement over whether, you know, whether DAs should be able to prosecute or can prosecute, you know, police officers in the jurisdictions that they operate in, which, you know, it should be possible, but there is, I mean, certainly there's a bias present, and that's what this executive order means to address by involving the Attorney General's office. But it wasn't law until after Dante Ivey was killed. So that means that David Soares has an obligation to pursue to the fullest extent that he can the investigation against those officers who ended his life.
Now, we're talking about the cops versus the citizens. And when people think about that, they think about a racial divide. Mm-hmm. There is the argument that there is more black-on-black violence mm-hmm. than white-on-black. What do you say to that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I say two things to that. One being almost that it's an irrelevant point because, of course, in a segregated society like ours, crimes will be more likely to be committed within one's race because you're more likely to live around and work around and be around people of your race. So it's true for all other races that crimes between people of your of whatever race you may be are higher than crimes between races. And that's only because we live in a segregated society where we happen to not interact as often with people of other races. It has nothing to do with the quality of blackness or the quality of the black experience that there are more black-on-black crimes than black-on-white crimes. It's strictly because we live in a segregated society where most black people live with other black people and most white people live with other white people. So white-on-white crime is just as pervasive in that sense, but it's also what it means to live with people. Like, sometimes things will go wrong, and that's sort of all that sits in that black-on-black crime, white-on-white crime conversation. But I would say, in addition to that white on black crime, or, you know, systemic violence against black people, which I think is a more accurate way to think about it, violence that's supported by the system, is the result of the history of this country. It's not just about the interpersonal disagreements that people get into. It's about the way that our laws and our institutions support the criminalization of blackness. So black people are punished more harshly, both physically and in the criminal justice system, for the same acts that white people engage in. And we don't see the same level of violence or punishment against white people for those same activities. And it's because we're sitting in a history that's fraught with anti-blackness, and we're living in a society that's fraught with anti-blackness. So I think that those two conversations are completely separate. And when we talk about the brutality that black people experience, we're not talking about a crime problem. We're talking about a social problem with anti-blackness.
Given the fact that there is a little dispute going on between the governor and DA,
mm-hmm.
what direction do you see the Donald Ivey case? What direction do you see it going in?
Well, the direction that I hope it goes in is one where the DA investigates and, you know, indicts the officers involved in his killing, because it's clearly a situation where people entered a scene and everything was fine, and then someone died at the end of their interaction. And that's a pretty, if that happened to any one of us, the DA would not question, he wouldn't rethink it, he wouldn't assess the situation, he would immediately arrest us and then proceed to enter grand jury proceedings and pursue an indictment against us. And for some reason, we've had months and months of an open investigation, grand jury investigation, for this case, which is completely aberrant from any other case where a person is killed. There, for some reason, right, like, these officers are walking the streets of Albany or Colony or East Greenbush or wherever they reside, and they're not arrested, and yet people are investigating whether or not they killed someone, which wouldn't happen for any of us. So what I'm hoping the direction that this goes in is indictments for those officers, because there's a saying that I recently learned, which is that a jury will indict a ham sandwich unless that ham sandwich is a cop. So for some reason, we've got months of investigation on a pretty clear-cut situation. And it's the district attorney's obligation to seek indictments when they believe a crime has been committed. And that's not happening in this case, and I hope that that begins to happen and that we see indictments.
Angelica, as this case unfolds, would you be willing to come back on Focus on Albany and talk about this case?
Absolutely. I would love to. And certainly, and maybe bring other people on next time. And sure, we'll continue the conversation.
Oh, thank you so much. You've been listening to Focus on Albany. You've been listening to Angela Clark. Angela, tell everybody your title again. I'm sorry.
I'm an organizer, Angelica, sorry, and I'm an organizer with Capital Area Against Mass Incarceration.
Thank you.
And you can find us on the internet.
Are you on Facebook?
Yeah, we're on Facebook, on Twitter, and we have a website. It's NYCAMI. So just look NYCAMI up, NYCAAMI, on Facebook, on Twitter, and on the web.
So speaking of Facebook, if you like this page, like us on Facebook, follow Focus on Albany and Twitter, and you can download on your smartphone, listen to Focus on Albany anywhere, anytime. Angela, thank you so much and have a great day. And thank you, everybody, for listening.